Welcome to Celebra Tragic, a podcast about tragic celebrities, with your hosts, Adam Todd Brown, and Carrie Martin.
Hey everybody, welcome to Celebra Tragic. I am Adam Todd Brown. Who are you?
Carrie Martin.
We are, if you can believe this, your hosts, and we are back. This is a new episode of Celebra Tragic. It's a new day for Celebra Tragic.
It's a new season with a little bit of tweaking.
Little twist. Instead of dedicating an entire season to one person, we're going to do the episodes more like we do the other podcasts, like Unpops, Conspiracy the Show, Pretty Scary, where we dedicate one episode. People know what I'm talking about. We're not going to do an entire season about one person because it's a lot of research for me and it's exhausting. So
it's not so hard for me. It's not very labor intensive for me, the reader of your notes. But yes, I could see how that would be a lot of work for you. But I like the short format. And I would love to hear from anybody out there listening. Give us story ideas for Adam to research and then me read the notes.
We will still do multi-part episodes about certain stories. Like we've been bandying about the idea of doing a Brittany Murphy season. And we're still going to talk about Brittany Murphy. But instead of like trying to stretch it to 7 or 8 episodes, we'll probably do like 2 or 3. So things aren't changing that much. Just a little.
There's definitely celebrity tragedies where it couldn't just be covered in one episode.
Right.
Like the Brittany Murphy one is multidimensional.
There's a lot to Murphy thing.
Right. And the Anna Nicole one and the Whitney Houston one, there were a lot of familial deaths in close time proximity. Say it with me, Adam.
Celebrity familial deaths in close proximity,
which made theirs, I think, worthy of covering so many different episodes because tangentially, a lot of people died.
A lot of people did die. And if that was
what still dying, to be honest.
Yeah. If that was what attracted you to this podcast initially, that you're going to hear about a lot of people dying, I want you to know that's not going to change, especially not on today's episode.
Welcome
back. We are talking about the death of Dimebag Darrell. Right off the top, Carrie, give me your top 5 Pantera songs.
Shoop. Waterfalls.
Right.
Milkshake. Putting on the Ritz. And American Bandstand.
American Bandstand? Is that the name of a song? Mine? Here we go. Walk, 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 and walk. Here's the thing. I was never a huge Pantera fan. They're a good band. It's just the genre in general. It's a weird thing, but heavy metal music makes me tired. There's something about it. Like, I respect it. I respect Pantera as a band. Their lead singer was a piece of shit, but I respect them as a band. I get it. They have songs that when I hear them, I'm like, that's a great fucking song. But if you put a whole Pantera album in front of me, I'm just going to be tired by the end of that because it feels
like a lot of screaming. It is like a rage room that just goes on for the length of the album.
Well, and I think different kinds of music speak to different types of personalities, and I'm just not that angry. Like, don't get me wrong, I'm a bitter monster inside, but not in a heavy metal way. Like, more in an indie rock way, I guess. Like an 80s rap way. I'm mad at the CIA. There we go.
So I went to a Nine Inch Nails concert once. Are they considered heavy metal? No, right?
Well, Nine Inch Nails are like industrial metal, kind of. Like they're in the neighborhood, but they're not like thrash metal or anything like that. But you also couldn't call them like just a rock band. They're a little heavier than that.
You know what's interesting, though, is for a lot of the people I know that are into heavy metal that wear like the black concert T-shirts and, you know, the skull rings and the studded belts and studded boots and whatnot. Some of the nicest people.
Well, the thing about it,
it's an expression.
Well, not just that, but I think what you see with a lot of heavy metal fans is they're kind of outsiders. That's a running theme with heavy metal music and the fans in general. And if you just reflect back on grade school or high school, it was usually the guy wearing the heavy metal t-shirts that people were like, oh, okay, Satanist. And I think that sort of explains why heavy metal fans can also be so very nice, because they just are looking for someone who doesn't treat them like a fucking freak. And when they encounter that person, they're going to be nice to that person, probably.
Everyone's looking for their group.
And that's not me saying all heavy metal fans inside are an evil, dangerous person waiting to come out. But I'm saying the opposite. I'm saying, you know, you shouldn't assume every metal fan is that, but there are a lot of outsider tendencies among metal fans. And that comes up a lot on this episode.
I also think you can be, not to dive too far into music, but I also think sometimes it can be like where you're at. Like, I've liked different genres.
Oh, just definitely.
Kind of dependent upon what I'm going through in my life. So I think there's a time and a season for genres too.
Yeah, I've definitely grown in and out of things. So for people who aren't familiar with Dimebag Darrell or Pantera, we'll run through that part very quick. Dimebag Darrell was born Dimebag Darrell, weirdly enough. How crazy is that? Just joking. He was born Darrell Abbott on August 20th, 1966. He was the guitarist for Pantera, which is a band he
was also a Leo.
Oh, is he?
Yes. Known for being fiercely protective.
Yeah. I don't want to make any jokes there. So he founded Pantera in the early 80s with his brother, Vinnie Paul. And what's really interesting about Pantera is if you go watch one of their videos in the incarnation that people know them as, which is with Phil Anselmo as the lead singer, they look like a band called Pantera. They're all dressed in black. The lead singer doesn't wear a shirt. They look like really bad dudes. But when they started, they were a glam metal band that wore makeup and sequins, because it was the early 80s and that's what men did. You wore a shit ton of makeup and you started a heavy metal band. It wasn't until Phil Anselmo joined the band that they changed that look. They were kind of like NWA. If you look at pictures of Dr. Dre in the early 80s, he's wearing sequin suits.
Was that when, do you remember when MTV had Headbangers Ball?
Yes.
Was that early 90s?
Headbangers Ball, I think, started late 80s. I don't know how we would ever find out.
Wasn't it Ricky Rockman?
April 18th.
On MTV was the host.
April 18th, 1987. Yeah, Ricky Rackman. Really famous episode of that show where Kurt Cobain showed up in a big yellow dress and Ricky Rackman was very uncomfortable. And Kurt Cobain said, "It's a ball. I decided to wear a gown." Very cute. So Pantera, they found most of their success in the 90s. They released three classic albums in a row, if you're a metal fan. Cowboys from Hell in 1990. Vulgar Display of Power, one of my favorite album titles of all time, in 1992. And Far Beyond Driven in 1994. Dimebag Darrell was and still is considered one of the greatest heavy metal guitar players of all time, Carrie. Pretty impressive.
I believe that. So you talk about liking Walk, and I believe that you named them. I believe you named that song as your favorite song of theirs for every option for Pantera. Can we hear a little bit?
Sure. I think so. Here we go. Right. My favorite part is when he goes, "What did you say?" The lead singer of this band is so aggressively masculine that for the entire time they were a band, people were like, "Dude, will you just come out already?" Like, there are so many rumors that he is a closet homosexual, which, if so, just come out already.
Phil?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if those rumors still exist. It's a different time when they were active as a band.
I'm gonna say, I mean, what is Phil and Selma up now?
I don't know. Probably heroin. Probably still doing a ton of heroin.
I was going to suggest, like, he owns a car dealership in Phoenix.
Probably, like in Cerritos or something. Cerritos Auto Center.
Cerritos Auto Square.
Phil Anselmo's Nissan at Cerritos Auto Square. Spec! Walk! What'd you say? That is Walk. So that's Walk by Pantera. Walk is probably their most famous song. And I say that because it's the song I know really well. So everyone else must know it very well also, I assume. So
yeah, they all kind of sound the same to me, but I did like it.
Walk is a great song. And the album it's on, that song is on Vulgar Display of Power. It's a good album. It's just, like I already said, I can listen to it once and I respect it, but I don't know. I'm not here to shit on Pantera. Pantera was a good band and I understand why people liked them. I don't feel like I don't need to keep bringing up that it's not exactly my cup of tea. Sort of beside the point.
I know what's not your cup of tea.
What's that?
Death.
True. I am not a fan of death at all. Do not take me.
Or murder.
Do not ask me to be your date for any funeral, even if I don't know the person. Mm-hmm. I will cry. Also, if you're asking people to be your date to a funeral, you're a fucking weirdo. So the problems started, for Pantera at least, in 2003. That's the year the band went through a very, very messy and public breakup. And during that breakup, Phil Anselmo did an interview with Metal Hammer magazine where he was quoted as saying, "Dimebag deserves to be severely beaten." And here's the thing, Carrie. That's how the band found out they were breaking up. They had no internal discussions. They didn't meet to talk about it. They just released an album that didn't sell that well. And then Phil Anselmo went to the press and was like, "Nah, they can fuck off and our guitar player should be severely beaten," which seems harsh.
So does anyone know, like, were there prior incidents where they didn't get along? Or I know you said there wasn't any sort of like internal talk. It seems so abrupt and it makes you wonder if he just didn't like them, if he thought he was bigger than them, or was it just they had a bad record and he was responding?
No, they hated each other. The band just clean fucking hated each other. They just never talked about breaking up. Like a lot of bands, like Nirvana mostly hated each other. Like they weren't really friends.
It's nice to be given a heads up when you're getting dumped. Especially in the press.
One of my favorite band firing stories is Axl Rose fired Slash from Guns N' Roses by sending him a fax as a canyon fire was converging on Axl Rose's house. So even though he had to evacuate and get his shit out of there, he was like, "I'm still going to take a second to fire you in the coldest, most impersonal way possible. Here's a fax."
That seems like the longest firing ever, because if you remember a fax machine, it ekes out. Like, it takes a minute. Like, you get to see it slowly come out of the machine, and it's letting you know, I guess, that you're a piece of shit and you're no longer a part of a very important, popular band. But you're saying there were canyon fires, like, in the Malibu canyons?
I don't know. Wherever Axl Rose lived, in fucking Axl Rose Canyon, probably.
Is that what happened to it? Something happened to his hair, right?
Something happened to all of Axl Rose. Every inch of him, something happened to.
But I heard he had cornrows for a reason. I don't know. That could be a different episode.
Maybe he went to the Caribbean on vacation. That's usually how it happens to white people. So after this interview comes out, Phil Anselmo is like, "Yeah, we're breaking up, but the thing about Dimebag being severely beaten, that was obviously just a joke." He said he was misquoted and really tried to downplay it because people were upset that he would say something like that. And then Vinnie Paul, who was the brother of Dimebag Darrell and the drummer in Pantera, he got an audio recording of the interview and listened to it. And he decided, no, Phil Anselmo was clearly not joking when he said this, and he tells the fans as much, and this leads to a big rift among Pantera fans. Half of them side with Phil Anselmo, the other half side with Vinnie Paul and Dimebag Darrell, who went off to start their own band called Damage Plan. Carrie, are you team Phil Anselmo or team Damage Plan?
Phil Anselmo seems like a jerk.
Yeah, you can't side with Phil Anselmo here. I'm sorry.
I don't like the cowardice of breaking up with somebody over an interview. The least he could do is send a fax.
Very passive aggressive.
Team Dimebag and Vinnie Paul.
Absolutely.
What about you?
Oh, 100% Team Dimebag. I mean, just from a drug perspective, if nothing else, I've always heard Phil Anselmo is way into heroin. Dimebag Daryl is named after my drug of choice, so I'm just naturally going to gravitate to him.
Weed. But also so strike one against Anselmo is the fact that he said it behind his back, like on an interview. And then two is that he was like, oh, I was just joking and misquoted. Again, what a pussy.
Yeah. Like, stick by it.
You had the chance. Yeah. You had the chance to come clean.
Also,
I wasn't happy. Let's break up.
Also, not to be that guy, but Phil Anselmo was huge. If you want Dimebag Daryl beaten, just go beat him up.
Right.
You don't have to be a dick about it in interviews. So
I want David Lee Roth out of here. Sammy Hagar in.
Yeah. Interesting that you bring that up, because one of the things I came across that I didn't put in the notes is that Vinnie Paul and Dimebag Daryl used the name Van Halen as like an expression of joy. Before they would go on stage, they would go Van Halen and high five each other and go out and play. And
is that their jump?
Yeah. And now allow me to put a very sad spin on that. Dimebag Daryl's last words, Van Halen. That's kind
you
of
don't know that.
No, that. That is confirmed in an interview with Vinnie Paul.
Really?
Yeah, that the last thing Dimebag Daryl said to anyone was he high-fived his brother and said, Van Halen! Those are some pretty great famous last words.
I mean, there's a lot of bad last words you could say. I feel like at least that meant something.
So Dimebag Daryl and Vinnie Paul go off to start Damage Plan. They release their debut album, Newfound Power, in February 2004. They spent the rest of the year touring behind that album. When they pulled into Columbus, Ohio, Chet Wilde's least favorite city in America, for a show at a club called Al Rosa Villa on December 8th, 2004, Carrie, they were just three shows away from finishing that tour. And coincidentally, it was the 24th anniversary of the murder of John Lennon. Ooh.
Death and DUIs, all within like a mile or a few shows.
Yeah.
At the end of your tour.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's the abbreviated version of events that led up to the night Dimebag Daryl was killed. He was a founding member of a beloved metal band with a notoriously angry fan base. And now that fan base is split down the middle, and one half of them is way angrier than usual. One of those angry Pantera fans, 25-year-old Nathan Gale. He graduated from Marysville High School in Marysville, Ohio in 1998, joined the Marines shortly thereafter, did not serve his full term though, and it's suspected his discharge was a Section 8 case, which confused me a lot when I first saw it.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Because where I come from, Section 8 means you get affordable housing on behalf of the government. That is not what it means if you're in the military. If you're in the military, it means you were discharged for mental health reasons. And
does that bother you?
I mean, no, it's just a little foreboding given where this episode's headed. When a friend asked if Gale at least enjoyed the time he was in the Marines, he replied, "Not really, but I learned how to blow stuff up, got to shoot a rocket launcher and some guns." And the friend in that interview also went on to describe Gale as, quote, "the last person you want to teach how to blow shit up," end quote. And yeah, that seems, in reading about this guy, that seems true. That seems like a fair assessment. He, this really, in a lot of ways, is a story about the failure of the mental health system in the United States.
Question, though, what kind of assessments, and I've seen that with some military people, and I don't know if it's like related to PTSD or some of them, like they want to go to the military because like they want that control. They want to feel powerful. They want maybe to kill someone or something and get away with it. So it's like, what kind of psychological reviews do they do when you're signing up?
That's a good question.
Like they do it for the NFL.
Yeah, you got it.
That's where they learned Aaron Hernandez was like nutty.
Yeah.
And then got him into a really good team where he continued to murder people.
Signed that huge contract and then murdered someone like a month later. crazy. With this guy, one of the things, or one of the impressions I get, is that it took a while for him to actually join the military in between high school and doing that. And in those years, it was already pretty clear that he was a little bit unstable. But then he came back from the military worse, if you can believe that. After this crime happened, they found writings in his possession that hinted at him being schizophrenic. But he, as far as I can tell, never really got treatment for that. When they did an autopsy on his body, obviously, I don't know what else they were going to do it on, after he died, they didn't find any antipsychotic drugs or any anti-schizophrenia drugs in his system.
Well, in all the notes you wrote, yeah, it didn't sound like he was diagnosed.
There's a December 2004 interview that we will link to, which is just kind of a compilation of interviews with Nathan Gale's friends. And one of the things that they bring up is that he did not take the breakup of Pantera well at all. He was obsessed with Pantera. This is a quote from one of those friends. When they broke up, I think he felt some kind of personal connection, like he felt left out or betrayed. This kid listened to their albums every day. He was obsessed with Pantera. And here's the thing. You might hear me say, oh man, I am obsessed with collecting every Mariah Carey album. But I'm not shoot someone on stage at a club obsessed. Normally, when people say obsessed, they just mean interested, or it's a side pursuit or a hobby, and they're just using very dramatic and flowery language to talk about it. Nathan Gale was obsessed, like clinically obsessed with Pantera.
So if I were to hold up a picture of Brian Tanaka right now, what level is your rage on a scale of one to Nick Cannon?
I'm going to be honest. I just want Mariah Carey to be happy. So
that's actually very mature of you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
You talking about this, though, and about his obsession, it reminds me a little bit of John Bardo and his obsession for Rebecca Schaefer.
Yeah.
And how he didn't like the movie she was transitioning into. And again, took it very personally that her career was evolving, where you'd be like how I felt about Anne Hathaway. Like, oh, she's taking on like sluttier role. You know what I mean? Like, she went from Princess Diaries to, I don't know, some more risque movie, because she wanted to a different career trajectory. But like, I wasn't overly affected by it, but also because I was never a huge Anne Hathaway fan.
Yeah.
But still, I don't think most people would take that personally. And I think, again, a lot of people who are fans sometimes, like, just like, you know, artists grow and change. So do the things we become fans of.
Yeah. And then for some people, it never changes. And they're just obsessed with one thing and they don't want it to ever change. And that was Nathan Gale. Here is a quote from sociologist Donna Gaines, who wrote the 1992 book Teenage Wasteland, which studied the role of heavy metal music in the lives of alienated or especially troubled kids. Here's the quote. Something about the music speaks to them on an inner psyche level. It really can become what recovery experts call a higher power. Somebody like Gale was searching for something to help him make sense of his feelings. And she also said this about how he would have taken the breakup of Pantera, which she says he likely would have treated like a parent abandoning a child. Here's the quote. He's not going to be able to get back on his feet and say, let me see what the band members' new music is. Maybe I can grow with them. Or fuck them. Let me check out Slayer. He didn't have that. What was at stake was survival, faith, hope, possibility, identification, community, which is a thing we were talking about earlier when discussing heavy metal fans. There is a palpable sense of alienation in that community. And sometimes it's just that, and you grow out of it, and sometimes you're Nathan Gale. Physically, on the other hand, Nathan Gale was a giant. He was 6'2", 265 pounds, played semi-pro football for a local team called the Lima Thunder, but he also wore glasses that were so thick his military friends called them birth control glasses because they repelled women. And let me tell you, I know a thing or two about very thick glasses.
What age did you wear them?
What age?
What ages?
did I wear glasses? I started wearing glasses in second grade, and my eyes haven't magically gotten better since then. So, but I wear contacts like an adult.
I want to say I wear really thick glasses, fifth to seventh grade, seventh, my ugliest year, pink, thick glasses. Either way, another thing. So if I couldn't be in the military for having flat feet, like, doesn't it seem weird that, like, if he was so visually impaired that he could be in the military?
Well, I mean, he's not joining the Air Force. I think you can have shitty vision and be in the Marines. He's in the Marines.
Then I can have flat feet.
It's well known that every Marine has shitty vision, Carrie. Will you be a little more of a patriot? Yeah, I think it is. Let's just move on. Here's a quote from another friend of Nathan Gale. You ever read of Mice and Men? Lenny? That's what Nate was like. He'd come running up to you and you weren't sure if he was going to hug you or snap your neck, which that's uncomfortable. It's a good way to make people uncomfortable. And when you combine outward displays of schizophrenia with being really physically imposing, it tends to make people a little on edge. So the employees of a tattoo shop where Nathan Gale would regularly hang out had to sometimes tell him to leave because he would just sit and stare at people, like lock in and stare at them without saying a damn word. And nope, nobody wants that.
Well, if he's not there to get a tattoo, it would creep me out too.
Yeah, I mean, a tattoo place is that kind of establishment where you'll have people who just come hang out.
Didn't it sound like he was doing that though?
Yeah. I mean, they described him as being mostly nice, but he was just a little weird sometimes. A friend quoted in one of the articles that we read for this said he and other friends started distancing themselves from Nathan Gale around April 2004 after he started claiming Pantera had stolen song lyrics from him and he started speaking about killing people.
And that's foreshadowing. That was 8 months before.
Yeah. Here's a quote from one of those friends. I wish I could have said something to somebody saying this guy could be dangerous, that this guy is just not right. All of us were Pantera fans, but he took it past being a fan. He took it to an obsession. And sorry, dude, you can't say anything to anyone because of deinstitutionalization. Thanks, Reagan.
I forget how much you hate most of our past presidents until you insert them in the notes.
But I do think this does kind of speak to deinstitutionalization. In this case, there was clearly some mental health issues at play. The first mass shooting I remember happened in 1984 in San Diego at a McDonald's. And if you look into that story, the guy who did that spent something like 6 hours on the phone the day before trying to get checked into a mental health facility. But by that point, in this country's history, there were no mental health facilities. There were some, but it wasn't like it was in the 60s and prior, where the government saw it as kind of a responsibility to take care of people with mental health issues. And then in the 70s, that just all flew out the window, and we decided the private sector could take care of it, and they cannot. So this entire set of circumstances converge on December 8th, 2004. And it starts at that tattoo shop we just talked about, which is called Bear's Den, which would also be a fantastic name for a gay bar.
I'm sure it is somewhere.
Probably.
Somewhere's multiple places.
And on this day, Gale was flipping through a tattoo magazine when, out of the blue, he asked a tattoo artist, awesomely named Bo Toler, how he would go about purchasing a tattoo machine of his own so he could get into administering some tattoos for cash, you know? This is a quote from Bo Toler. I started telling him about how you need to have a license to have that sort of equipment. He threw the magazine down and said, "Bullshit, you're a liar," and walked right out. It surprised me. He never showed anybody his temper before. And that's a very important detail because it's often suggested that even though there's obviously underlying issues at play, mass murders are almost always provoked by a single triggering event that happens like hours or at most days before the killing. This is a quote. It's typically a rejection or a public humiliation. The murderer is taking revenge against all those individuals who have hurt and mistreated him for as long as he can remember. And in his mind, he had a right to do this. That's Dr. J. Reed Malloy, forensic psychologist. Dr. J. That's cool. So a few hours after that tattoo shop incident, Nathan Gale pulled his 1995 Pontiac Grand Am into the parking lot of the Alrosa Via nightclub, where Dimebag Darrell and Damage Plan were headlining a 3 or 4 band bill. For some reason, those details vary from source to source. Carry tickets were $8. It was a Wednesday night. When's the last time you went to something that only cost $8 that wasn't a comedy show that should cost no dollars?
They have like a crab fest or a crawfish festival down in the port of Long Beach. I think that was the last time.
I would pay yourself? $8 to go to a crawfish festival, I guess.
It's a lot of crawfish and I'm not a fan. So
was Pantera playing?
The crawfish won that. Yes. I probably had two. So what I pay, like $4.
You had crawfish. Two crawfish at the crawfish festival? It's like having two shrimp.
I didn't really, I guess, realize what all was entailed. I think the sucking of the head. I felt like maybe they were spicy.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't want to eat anything. Anyhow, I got to suck out of its shell. Ugh.
It felt like a lot of work.
So when he shows up at this club, at first he just sits in his car for like 3 hours staring at the club. During that time, he's asked to move his car several times, finally parks it right by Damage Plan's tour bus. Perfect. Ideal. Like, no one could tell him to move from that spot too. Whatever. So after that, he gets out and just kind of lurks around the parking lot. He spots the band security chief, a guy named Jeffrey Mayhem Thompson, and asked him if Dimebag or Vinny were on the bus. And Thompson told him to beat it, but he was nice about it. And after that, Nathan Gale just paces around the parking lot for a while. At one point, a fellow patron sees this and tells him the opening act is on and maybe he would want to come inside. And Gale replied that he, quote, didn't want to see no shitty local bands, which, nice, dude. Come on, show some support. What if that was your shitty local band up there?
Right. Then it's like, why are you here? And was he wearing a Pantera shirt or a Damage Plan shirt?
He had a Damage Plan CD in his car, but he was wearing a Columbus Blue Jackets hockey jersey, I believe, which is also a known sign of that's a warning sign that aggression is on the way. Someone's walking towards you wearing a hockey jersey. No, no. So around 10:15 p.m., he took one more try at asking to see Dimebag Darrell on the tour bus. This time, he was told by the band's sound man, Aaron Barnes, that the band had already gone inside the club. So with that, Gale turns and starts walking toward the club, and then he hears cheers from the crowd, and that's when he realizes Damage Plan is already on stage. And with that, he starts running, which didn't alarm anyone, because that's what you do when you're at a concert and the band you're there to actually see has taken the stage, but you're out in the hallway securing a beer still. You run back to your seat, or at least you give it a quick stride. So no one was freaked out by him darting off in a sprint toward the club. What was weird was when, instead of going to the front door and presenting his ticket, he just climbed a fence and entered the club through the side door. And there's a really interesting detail in a Rolling Stone article that we'll link to where they mention that the fence he climbed was surrounding an outdoor patio, like a smoking area. And the people who were out there saw him climbing the fence and they just thought he was a broke kid trying to get in the club for free. So they start like cheering him on and helping him over the fence. And then when he walks in the club, there's a security guard right there and he like pushes the guy out of the way and moves through. And even then, the bouncers and the security guards still thought he was just someone trying to get in for free. So no one was alarmed at first, even though it was a very alarming sequence of events.
Right. I mean, was that in the day of like mosh pits and stuff where people are kind of just like pushing each other around?
Well, it's not just in the day of mosh pits, but this is also still the era of stage diving, where fans would just run up on stage and jump off. And what were you going to say?
I somehow was involved in a very odd mosh pit at a Blink-182 concert where I was wearing like a floral dress and a white sweater because apparently I got lost on the way to like a Ross Dress for Less. And I went to this Blink-182 concert with some friends from college. And at one point, my white sweater got torn off and trampled on. And somebody started pelting people in the mosh pit, including myself, with lemons, limes, and oranges. I was like, who brings citrus to a Blink-182 concert?
That's what you get for moshing at a Blink-182 concert.
I was on the fringe. I got drug in.
Okay. Well, I mean the mosh pit in general for forming at a Blink-182 concert deserved to be pelted. That's not moshing music. Get over yourselves. So he pushes past the security guard and two bouncers are following him. And even then, they're still like, all right, this is just a guy trying to get in for free. We'll get him and we'll take him out. But he eventually picks up the pace and moves toward the stage area. When he reaches that stage area, he first pushes past the club's 19-year-old assistant, Emily Lewis, and past a stagehand named Aaron Houck. And he walks onto the stage. This is a quote from Emily Lewis. My first reaction was, okay, he's just a kid who's going to crowd surf. Then I remember seeing him come right in front of the drum riser. End quote. And so he's on stage now, and he walks toward Dimebag Daryl and allegedly shouts something along the lines of, you messed up Pantera. There are versions of that quote that are longer. There are sources that will tell you they're not sure if he said anything at all because there was a heavy metal concert underway at the time, but it's believed he said something along those lines. And as he's doing that, at that point, the stagehand he passed, Aaron Houck, who is a 6'1" former Marine, and Mayhem Thompson, the security chief that he met outside, who was even bigger, they were converging on him from both sides of the stage. And before they could reach him, he grabs Dimebag Daryl, puts him in a headlock, and shoots him 3 times in the back of the head. And then shoots one more time and hits him in the hand. But by that point, he was already dead. And so Emily Lewis flees the club to call police. And Houck and Thompson finally reach Gale and try to wrestle the gun away. But in the scuffle, they both get shot too. And they are also killed. And at that point, fans just rush the stage. Half of them are trying to assist Dimebag Daryl, and the other half are trying to stop the shooting that is still in progress. During all of that craziness, he shoots Damage Plan's tour manager, a guy named Chris Paluska, and their drum tech, a guy named John Brooks. They both survive. And then an especially weird thing happens. His gigantic birth control glasses fall off his stupid face, and he asks a member of one of the opening acts, a guy named Jeff Green, if he'll help him look for his glasses. And he starts motioning at the floor with his gun, and it accidentally goes off. And that is the last bullet he has in his clip. When that happens, he pulls out another clip and makes eye contact with a kid who's on stage kneeling over Dimebag Daryl. And this kid is giving what we all recognize as the universal sign for what the fuck, dude. He's got his arms out, his shoulders a little raised. Like, what are you doing? And Nathan Gale said nothing, loaded the clip, shot him in the chest and killed him. So, side note, I don't know if this is going to break the tension of this moment at all. It shouldn't, because it's a very dark detail. The name of that opening act, 12 Gauge. Also, I skipped over this in the notes. The song Damage Plan was playing when Nathan Gale and shot Dimebag Daryl, it's called Breathing New Life. This fucking
Breathing
story.
New Life?
Breathing New Life. Yeah.
Sad thing is, the poor kid who ran on stage, which is interesting because I would have ran for an exit, but good for him. I mean, he ran on stage, you know, trying to help out, but 24-year-old Nathan Bray died. A 24-year-old who wanted to go to an $8 concert on like a Wednesday night.
Yeah.
What if that was me? Not to bring this back to me, but what if one of those lemons struck me in the head at just like the right place on my temple and I died in that mosh pit at a Blink-182 concert?
That'd be a bad concert to die at. Going to be completely honest. Blink 182.
All concerts. Hashtag all concerts are a bad concert to die at.
Yeah. I would agree with that. But yeah, that thing where people rush the stage actually saved a lot of lives because in that moment, the police were still arriving. So they could have just let this guy keep shooting and everyone tried to flee. But instead, people did try to stop this. And that ultimately kept more people from getting killed. But in that whole melee, after he ends up shooting two more people and shoots Nathan Bray, he starts waving the gun around and basically backing up like he's going to try and make his escape, which, like, where do you think you're going to go, dude? Come on. As he's doing that, police start entering the club from all sorts of directions. One of them is a 31-year-old cop named Officer James Niegemeier, which is how I'm going to pronounce that name. He came sneaking up alongside the main stage speakers, holding a Remington 12-gauge shotgun. At that moment, Nathan Gale grabs John Brooks, who he had already shot in the leg, the drum tech for the band, and tries to use him as a human shield. And at that same moment, Officer Niegemeier steps out from the stage door with his shotgun raised to confront Gale. When John Brooks, the hostage, moves just a little bit, James Niegemeier shoots Nathan Gale in the face with a 12-gauge shotgun. So needless to say, he died instantly. Mm-hmm. And after he shot him, Officer Niegemeier just started muttering to himself and to anyone else who would listen, "I had to do it. I had to do it." It's like, we know.
That's got to be traumatizing, though.
Oh, yeah. We'll get into it. Just like he was traumatized.
At a concert. Yeah.
So that was the end of all the killing. In all, four people were killed. Three others were injured but survived. Actually, I mean, if you count Nathan Gale, five people were killed. But what happened that night has just been impacting things forever and ever since. For one, it's often called the worst day in metal history for very obvious reasons. In the aftermath, Nathan Gale's mother got a ton of death threats. This is a quote from her. "Nothing I can say about him is going to erase what happened in the end. In those few minutes, I'm sorry for what happened. I'm sorry for those people who were killed, but I lost a son too." And that's true. Well, I think we forget about that a lot in situations like this where, I mean, I guess there's some cases where you can be like, that parent should have watched their kid better. But I doubt there's anything this kid's mom could have done to stop this.
Yeah, I mean, maybe there were signs when he was growing up or, you know, but then he went to the military. I don't know. And it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, it's true. Like, she's grieving too. And I think it's so easy to be like, well, F you, Mary Clark, you know, like you raised a monster, but, you know, it's not like she raised him that way.
Yeah. Possibly, and that,
unless she kept him in a cage.
And I think that also speaks to the institutionalization, which we mentioned before. There's a documentary I recommend to people all the time. It's on HBO. It's called A Dangerous Son. And it's about this woman whose kid he's a bad kid. Like, he beats the shit out of his sister all the time. He's just insanely angry and violent. And this documentary is just her trying day after day to get this kid some sort of mental health help. And she cannot do it. At one point, she calls and finds out that there's something like 200 total mental health beds in the state of Washington. Not 200 for kids, not 200 for old people, 200 total. And all along the way in this documentary, she's like, my kid's gonna murder somebody. Like, I have to deal with this. And you can't. Like, there's nowhere to go for help. We made that a national policy.
There's a series, it's either on Investigation Discovery or now Discovery Plus, called Evil Lives Here. And a lot of them talk about specifically, it's typically their kids. But sometimes it's like, oh, my brother or my sister grew up evil. And we knew they'd torture animals. They would torture me. They would, you know, parents would talk about, you know, their sons pulling guns on them or standing over their beds with machetes. And they're just kind of like, is this a phase? Or like, they're just like, he was always different.
Yeah.
I don't know. And, you know, it's very antisocial behavior. It's very, you know, very angry, but it's like, you know, you look and it's kind of like, these are just normal families. Like, he was just born that way, I guess, is the best way to say it. Like, something was just always off with these people. And then a lot of them weren't diagnosed until it was too late.
And I think the not until it's too late thing is important too, because I think a lot of us grew up having that friend. Like that one friend who you're like, I don't know, that person's kind of weird. They might do something someday. But then you still don't really expect them to do it. And this kid...
I didn't have that friend.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. Like, maybe not everyone, but like you've I think everyone has at least known someone in their life where you're like, I don't know, they seem a little off. And maybe not. Maybe everyone... Here's the thing, Carrie. If you don't know anyone like that...
Maybe it's me.
Maybe it's you.
Maybe it's me.
Yeah, yeah. So great. Now I know that person again. Cool. But yeah, that's kind of the vibe you get reading about this guy. And the impression his friends give is just that he just always seemed a little weird. And it wasn't necessarily angry, but... Like, there's one story where a guy talks about how they were driving somewhere together and Nathan Gale brings up Pantera. And the guy's like, yeah, whatever. Pantera is like shitty 80s metal. I don't care about them. And he said at first, Nathan Gale got really angry, but then he seemed like he got over it pretty quick. And then he was just quiet for like 20 minutes. And after 20 minutes, he goes, you really think they suck? And he said the way he said it, you could tell he was just fuming about it inside the whole time and just had to bring it back up. And it's like, he was that kind of person, like the kind of person where you just don't know if things are going to spin out of control at some point. And when you're dealing with someone that huge too, if things spin out of control, it's going to get bad, even if he doesn't have a gun. Someone else who didn't come out the other end of this looking good at all was Phil Anselmo. If you can believe that, because he gave that interview and said Dimebag Daryl should be beaten severely. And not long after that, fan shoots him in the head on stage. So people were mad about that. And things got so bad in that respect that at one point, investigators actually looked into the theory that Phil Anselmo was involved in the killing and that somehow he had communicated with Nathan Gale. When they looked into that, not only did they find that that was not true, they didn't find any Pantera or Damage Plan CDs, merchandise, or magazines at all in Nathan Gale's apartment, which, given his documented obsession with Pantera, that's one of the weirdest details in this whole fucking story. I don't understand that at all.
Well, maybe he got rid of it before.
Yeah, I mean, that it would have to be that, but if he did, no one saw him do it. No one talked about it. So there's another sad epilogue to this story, which is Officer James Niegemeier, who is the cop who shot and killed Nathan Gale. Obviously, a justified killing. There's no question about that. No one ever questioned if it was justified or not. He was obviously hailed as a hero after it happened. This is a quote from Alrosa Villa club owner Rick Cautela. Do you know how quick he came in here? Do you know how many more lives could have been taken that night? It was unbelievable. Because here's the thing, when that first call went out, he was sitting in his car like a block away from this club. So he did show up right away. And at the point where he shot Nathan Gale, they later found out Nathan Gale had 35 more rounds. So a lot more people could have died if this cop didn't show up when he did. But James Niegemeier never, ever, ever recovered from this. He remained on patrol for 3 more years, but on the advice of doctors who had diagnosed him with PTSD, it was decided he should no longer be a first responder. And then somehow they decide the proper next move is to move him to the robbery division to be a detective, which I guess I can see how that might seem like a logical transition, because then at least you're never going to be in a situation where you roll up on a homicide, probably. But that didn't work either.
Yeah, no, I agree. Again, like, you know, it's part of the job, but especially that night, it's like, dude, I'm going to a concert with a bunch of, you know, prepubescent teens or early 20-year-olds. Like, what's the worst that's going to happen? Like, you're probably just, like, you know, coasting, like, jacking off in a bathroom stall that night.
Yeah.
Right, Adam?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I would be. I don't know if the cop who shot Nathan Gale was. He was outside in his cop car when the call went out.
you didn't anyway. Read that in your article?
I did not. No. I skipped where I put that in the notes. But
because the pages were stuck together.
Right. So, yeah, they try moving him to the robbery division as a detective, and that didn't work either. This is a quote from James Niegemeier. "I found out real quickly that you don't have any control over your brain. It's going to do what it's going to do. Cops are regular human beings. Things affect us the same way they affect everyday citizens. We relive it and have to deal with the aftermath." So he was eventually moved to a non-police job with the city. So he at least kept his job. He just, his career path changed very dramatically. And here's the thing, Carrie. I think everyone listening to this knows where I stand in general when it comes to the police. So when I come away from a story feeling bad for the cop who shot someone in the face, you know we are dealing with a different kind of story. But
right.
In this case, I mean, obviously called for.
The worst part is if that officer would be driving around in a car that he bought from Phil Anselmo Chevrolet.
Yeah. Phil Anselritos. Mm-hmm. Phil Anselritos. Something else that changed in the aftermath of the murder of Dimebag Darrell should come as a surprise to no one. Here's a quote from Anthrax guitarist Scott Ian. "After something like that happens to one of your best friends, how could you ever feel safe anywhere ever? The few times that kids have made it up onto the stage during our show, no matter how friendly the scenario, the first thing I think is, dude, you should not be on this fucking stage. You should know better. To me, everything changed after Dime was killed. The stage became off limits for everyone but musicians. I don't give a fuck how much fun you're having. Stay the fuck off the stage." End quote. And yeah, I've been to a lot of concerts since 2004. I think it's safe to say I've been to hundreds of concerts since 2004. And I don't remember the last time I saw someone hop up on a stage and dive off. And before anyone in the audience is like, yeah, but do you go to shows where the tickets are $8? No, they're $15 now because it's 2021. And also, feel free to jump in the comments and say, well, my favorite band still lets people do that. I will reply that your favorite band is stupid. If you want to have that interaction, go ahead. But it makes sense that this would change after something like this. This is like 9/11 for the relationship between a band on stage and fans. Like, once that trust is broken that way, you can't ever go back. It would be like going back to just letting the cockpit doors and airplanes swing open mid-flight. Can't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm. They need, like, that COVID plexiglass, too. This is, like, one extra barrier for physical safety and pandemic safety.
I did watch a concert once at First Avenue in Minneapolis, and I got there so late I had to watch it from this, like, bar area that had plexiglass in front of it. I hated it. It was like watching it on TV. So distracting. And I could hear fine. It was just like, ugh.
Right.
I have this film.
That extra barrier.
Yeah.
It's annoying.
So, yeah, that was a bummer. But that's the
sad way to go.
That's the story of the murder of Dimebag Darrell. Next time around, our next episode's going to be a lot more lighthearted, talking about unsolved celebrity murders. Not as many as you would think, because we solve celebrity murders, unless it's a rapper that was murdered by the government, obviously, or Natalie Wood getting chucked into the river by Robert Wagner.
She wasn't a celebrity, though. Oh, Natalie Wood. I was thinking Natalie Holloway. My apologies.
Natalie Wood was quite a celebrity. Natalie Holloway is a celebrity now.
Yeah, posthumously.
Right. So
I'll be honest. I was looking through this list you put together. I don't know a lot of these names.
Yeah, they're going to be some obscure names, but they're interesting stories. Again, we either could talk about unsolved celebrity murders on the next episode and talk about a few obscure names, but interesting stories, or we could talk about solved celebrity murders. And then that would take about 45 episodes because famous people get murdered all the time.
Right. No, I like a good, interesting story. So I'm actually excited for that. And I like things are even celebrity tangentially. Like even if you know a celebrity or like saw one at the mall once and you got murdered, like I want to know every detail about that.
That's true. So we're going to give people those details on the next episode, which will be a bonus episode that you can get on the Patreons and on the Supercasts. Patreon.com/unpops or unpopsnetwork.supercast.tech. Carrie, do you have anything to plug?
I will be watching my soulmate and best friend, Winter Soldier Neeson, who is also your dog, in a couple of weekends.
Congratulations.
Common ground that we're making the swap at, which is a Chili's in Torrance. And I will say that we'll probably be on TikTok that night.
Very cute. Looking forward to it.
Catch us there.
All right. Let's get the hell out of here. Carrie, say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, everybody. We love you.